I knew you'd hear the looking good.
This is the PA mic. Is that a little bit better? Okay.
This is
the
PA.
This is the PA.
I didn't even know we had
PA. We didn't until about a minute ago.
This is taping. This will pick up.
All right. I believe the most important thing that will happen this weekend is when you all are talking to one another. So as long as you're doing that, I will not interrupt. The toughest part of any group activity comes after any break in the regathering. Very difficult. And it's a life thing. That's just an automatic response to so many photo shoots. For 11 years, I did a little retreat in Santa Barbara, California for a group of loonies out of the Los Angeles and Santa Monica Basin. I love them dearly, but I'm glad I don't live there. Monastery outside of Santa Barbara up on the hill. Lovely, lovely place. But regathering was always difficult. And on this one particular occasion, we had a couple of professional singers who were sitting next to me. I'm not used to hearing myself talk. That's terrible.
Don't listen.
And everybody's busy chatting and we're not getting back to it. And they know how I operate. I won't interrupt. So one of them went, his partner just reflex went, It was just gorgeous. It just went out over the room. It was beautiful. And at the next break when we came back in, they did it again, and a couple people out there joined in. The room got quiet, and I got this vision in my head. Oh, my God. They're going to go back down into the L.A. Basin and say, look what Don taught us at the retreat. Being on time is absolutely critical to the spiritual life. And I'm not talking about the clock. The clock comes from that. It doesn't come from the clock. There's only one time. There's only one place, and that's here and now. The only time I can experience the presence of God is now. So I must be on time in order for that to occur. We've had a lot of fun with that, and I'm going to turn this over to Tom real quick and follow his lead. But being on time sometimes does translate down to the clock, because rudeness was my worst character defect. Imposing myself into your life without asking if you had time for me or even wanted me there. Or making appointments and meeting either too early or too late. It's all rude. So I watch for that. So being on time is very important in human relations. If we say we're going to do something together and pick a time and a place to do it, we should both be there at that time and place. And on time for me, on the clock, there's a 10-minute leeway on either side of it. We live in a world that you can't get too precise. It's a principle, not a rule. Where I worked was three blocks away from a place in Denver that was built to serve people with garlic deficiencies. It was a little place called Dario's, a little Italian restaurant. And I have a serious garlic deficiency. So, it's so
cured
good.
Cured it last night.
We dipped the garlic in garlic dip, boy. It's so good that at lunchtime, there's no place to park within 3 blocks, literally. And that's not just because of Dario's, but that's part of it. As a result of mistreating this poor old body, I now have neuropathy in my feet. So there's days I can walk and there's days I can't. And one of the guys I sponsored came by to take me to lunch because I allow that. Never expected, but I sure do like it. Pay attention. Anyway, it was one of those days I couldn't walk too well. So we went over to my van. He said, "This is silly. You know you're not getting a place to park." I said, "Just get in the car." That's sponsor talk. Just get in the car. We drive up to Dario's, and as we pulled up, a car pulled out, and I parked right in front of the place. Now, I expect that. He was stunned. He said, "My God, God got us a place to park," and I wanted to slap him. God doesn't care where I park. We were on time. That's all. And I promise you, there's a rhythm that you get into that beyond your intellect that helps you to be literally on time, both on the clock and within your personal life. And it's worth getting a hold of. So we were in New York in December, and one of the guys I sponsor in Hilton Head has a guy in New York, and when I asked how we're going to get from LaGuardia to here, he said, "He'll take you." That's sponsor talk. He'll take you. John Calasanto, lovely young Italian boy, understands garlic deficiencies. So he picks us up at LaGuardia, and the couple with us were staying down in the East Village, and we were staying over in Brooklyn Heights. So we're going to deliver them first, and we discover on the way that John's never been to the East Village. He's driving the car. And I can promise you, in the East Village, there's no place to park. You might as well just go on uptown. We pulled down to the corner where these people live, and a car pulled out, and he parked. And so I told him about being on time. All weekend, it was wonderful watching him be on time. Then on Monday morning at 5:30, we're supposed to go to the airport and get an airplane. And John isn't there. And we're staying at his mother's house, so she called. He somehow is still asleep. We just barely made our airplane. And he told me on the way over, he said, "I got so intrigued with this business of being on time, I started managing it." Tom?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, I guess. I tell you, there's a buddy of mine uses the term the power of now. And boy, is that ever a powerful concept? Because history has no power. It has value, but it doesn't have power. And the future doesn't either. If I'm living in one or the other, I'm almost powerless. And so a real, real important concept of being where I am and recognize that this is it. This ain't preparation. This is it. I'd like to just sort of continue along with Ross. Let me ask you. The mic won't pick up stuff from the group, will it? Okay. Now, I personally really like interactive stuff. You know, I think there's an absolute relationship between participation and value. And might make this deal with you if to just selfishly get a little of that. Let me just make it available. If you want to ask a question or make a comment, and can do it in a sound bite style, you know what I mean, not a long question. Sometimes I'll get to listen to those C-SPAN programs, and I swear to God, the question's longer than the presentation. You know, so, but if you can just sort of distill it, and then what we can do is repeat it, because it is maddening on a tape to listen to an answer that's not connected to a question. So, brilliant answer, but what's it about? You know. And so if you would, and if you just want to make comments, same thing, just kind of, just not because we wouldn't want to hear you, but because we couldn't remember it, and just about make it soundbite style. But I would really appreciate that. Because what I'd like to kind of lead us into is continuation of this effectiveness deal. Now, I suspect that that this group is essentially, I know we've got some pretty new cases here, but that's the minority. I suspect this group are people who are involved fairly heavily in the business of working with others. And there are some real tricky grounds in that business of working with others, that sometimes the harder we work, the less we get. And that old cryptic kind of comment that less is more really applies sometimes in this business of effectiveness. And so I'd like to just kind of talk a little bit more about that, and for that reason, I'd really like to get some interactive stuff in there if we can. Now, I have to warn you, I'm not somebody who milks a crowd, you know, so I make that offer, but it's up to you to get in, because when I get going, it's kind of like jumping on a running train. I mean, old man. So just give me a signal, or just speak up if you want to do something like that. Jumping ahead just a little bit to 19, that first paragraph. The other one's talking about those personal qualities that sort of earn the confidence and open up the dialogue with an alcoholic. And we spent some good time last night out on the porch chasing mosquitoes and talking about effectiveness and the frustration that comes from working hard and getting in our own way. And so that one paragraph, I'll just kind of go through that paragraph with you. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. I was sitting in a meeting last week in my home group, and we have a little spin-off group that's a big book, just a big book discussion type thing. And there was a gal there, a fine person, who was talking about this paragraph this statement in the context of working professionally in the field. And that's a subtle trap involved in that, because there is a tremendously important difference between work that I do professionally and work that I do as an avocation in this giving for free and for fun. And so this thing here, this is, I guess, it was kind of an interesting case, you know, that I won't beat you to death with the case, but This gal is fairly new to our group, and she's got some disease. I don't know what it is, none of my business, but it has put her in a wheelchair, and she's pretty profoundly disabled. And so when she was talking about what she did as a vocation in response to this paragraph, she talked about what she had done as a professional evaluator and teacher of drunk driving. I mean, I don't think they're teaching drunk driving. Whatever they teach, I never have been through that, but thank God. But she was talking about that in the context of this business about how doing this as a vocation can interfere with our effectiveness. Well, let me talk about two levels of that just a minute. One is the obvious. You know, if I can't learn to distinguish what I do professionally from what I do personally, I got no business in that profession, because I'll get nothing but trouble and cause nothing but grief. And I know a lot of people, I sponsor a lot of folk who have worked in treatment, and the biggest problem that happens is when folks forget where they are and forget how to distinguish clearly and importantly between the two. So a tremendously important thing. Recovered alcoholics have a great contribution to make in that field. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. But if we can't understand the professionalism of that, it's a real booger bear. And so when I'm working with somebody who works professionally in the field, part of the way that I monitor them is to listen to them in meetings. I don't need to ask them 20 questions. I listen to them in meetings. And when I hear somebody in a discussion that gets into therapeutic counseling, I know we need to go to the woodshed because it's gotten out of whack. Or if I hear somebody making a talk and it's a lecture, and it happens so easily with somebody who's accustomed to doing lectures, and they start doing a talk, and that lecture format comes in. And when that happens, it kills the value of the avocation, the value of the gift of this earning the trust and confidence. So it's a tremendously important thing in terms of maintaining the viability and the effectiveness. If I can't distinguish that, then I've got a lot of trouble. So it's a challenge, a real challenge. I'm sure you run into, Shelley does, well, I don't mean to put your business in the street, but she does professional research, and excellent research. But those kind of things can really steal your mind, you know, and you get to thinking analytically about what's happening here instead of the experience, of feeling the experience. And so it's a tricky area. The other part of that, and part of what we were talking about last night, is about the good balance that makes the recovery that I practice attractive to somebody else. And it makes it effective with other people. I'll give you a couple examples. When I first got on the street and started, I had the privilege, it really was a privilege, it didn't seem like it at the time, but I had the privilege of helping start Alcoholics Anonymous. Restart Alcoholics Anonymous in a fairly large city in our state, because it just died, you know, and so it was a very, very busy time, and I sponsored about everybody in town, just about everybody that was sober. It wasn't many. It was a gang, more than I could keep up with. And back then, that sponsor talk that Don was talking about was my language. During that period, My basic message to folk was get in the car. And if this car's full, get in the next car. You know. And what we would do would be to chase around the meetings within reasonable access, the meeting within 50 miles we could usually make, and run convoys. And that was really the deal. And I'm sponsoring so many people, I can't even get to know all of them, much less work with them intensively. Well, and that was fine. And I'll guarantee you, if a campaign had been put out to identify the best sponsor in the known world, among those guys, it would have been me. I guarantee you, Tom Iverson was the finest thing that has ever come along, the finest speaker the world's ever known. Of course, the only one it ever had. But it would have been a handy, hands-down victory, but... Well, a troubling thing happened. 2 years after I went into that city and we got a good, strong group going, I had to move away. And all but one got drunk. All but one. Does that mean I was a lousy sponsor? Well, not necessarily. You know, I was doing the best I knew. I just didn't know enough. And see, what I was so busy doing... was I was so busy doing the stuff of get in the car or you sweep the floor, and that I never did let them see what the solution was. You know, I never did get into the solution with them. All they knew is that I was wonderful, and if they followed me, they were okay. Well, they were right as long as I was available to do that. But the minute I stepped back, See what I'm talking about? The effectiveness doesn't come from that kind of charismatic cheerleader stuff. It's about real solutions, real connection to their life, and not just being a camp follower to me. And so even though it was well-intended, you know, effectiveness required more. And you know, what it was saying on there earlier about being equipped not only with experience, but with having real insight about myself, real knowledge about this program, who has really found a solution and is able to communicate that to somebody else. Yeah, I didn't quite make it that far. And so it can really interfere, you know, with getting that. I'm an extremely active member of AA, and I've had an interesting history in a way. You're talking about a young people's group, but you got. I started the first young people's group in North Carolina. There were three of us, and the group still meets to this day. 38 years ago, we started that group. And so at that time, I was the youngest member of AA in North Carolina. And I thought in the whole world, because God knows, I could never show anybody that. And strange thing happens, if you keep on breathing, I'm now the oldest recovered man in North Carolina. I'm the relic of the past. The only thing is that I'm still one of the most active people I've ever met. And that has a real, it's part of what we were talking about last night. That's a double-edged sword. That thing cuts both ways. Because it's when you get a guy that's the oldest guy in the state that's as active as I am, this can have a repelling effect on people. It's not necessarily going to be a galvanizing magnet to people. It can be a repelling factor. And this business of being able to demonstrate a life that speaks of the solution is tremendously important. And so I have to recognize that most people are probably not going to be able to take off like I do. Important for me to recognize that we are truly different people. And we're driven by different forces. I'm somebody in my simplistic way of looking at stuff. I like to keep it simple so I can understand it. I like to think that my recovery has to match my drinking pattern. If my recovery doesn't match up with how I drank, I'm probably going to find it a little lacking. Because that's my chemistry. That's the way I function. That's the way I am. I'm basically a kind of guy that has a lot of compulsive drive. I'm not somebody who can sit and vegetate. I'm somebody who's, like Don said, the mind doesn't shut down for a long time. And I also have to keep in mind that a considerable amount of what I do in AA is a part of my amends structure. It's not just zeal to be a missionary. It's about a very real and effective way of making amends. And so I have to keep that in mind when I'm working with people and not try to get people to emulate who I am. Tremendously important, because I've had so many people, it's what we were beating around last night, who said that they had difficulty working with me because it was intimidating. It is not invigorating or inspiring, but intimidating. To work with somebody that's got that kind of energy and zeal to do stuff. So when I'm looking at effectiveness, it's important for me to recognize what is effective. What's the right agenda? How do I help people achieve their potential and not conform to my model? And that's an important thing. Like I was at a prison one night at Central Prison in Raleigh, in maximum custody joint, and a guy came over to after me. Now to picture this, I'm in a maximum custody joint. Guy comes over to the meeting, he was talking a little bit, and he said, "Let me ask you a personal question, if you don't mind." I said, "Yeah, anything, go on." He said, "Do you have to do this thing like you do it to stay sober?" I said, "Well, not necessarily." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I swear to God, you're so busy." you make me tired. You know? And I said, well, no, you really don't have to do it like I do. But I said, one thing you ought to take a look about that. You sitting in a maximum custody prison saying you don't want the kind of life I got, and I'm walking the street. I ain't swapping with you either, buddy. But it's a sneaky thing, y'all, in this thing of what it is that I convey to people. And if I want to be effective, you know, it's important for me to take a look at what kind of an example I'm being. What kind of expectations do I put on the book? And does my life really reflect a kind of life that looks like sobriety is a good thing to do? And so it's not just a given that just because I've been there that I'm going to be a real effective guy. You want to comment about that any, Don?
Sure. Huh? Why not?
Go for it.
No, I was musing and listening. We only have one thing that we're supposed to do. That's carry our message to the person who doesn't know. And then whenever possible, lead them on the journey of self-discovery. They'll suggest to us that anytime we're approaching a new person, we should get into their shoes and see how they would like to be approached, rather than me coming out of my box and laying it on. 1988, I've had the privilege of serving this fellowship from the beginning. And in the mid-80s, I was your trustee at large U.S., which I thought was funny. I am not trustee material, but I was a good one. But as a result of that, we had occasion in November of 1988 to be invited by the Russians to the Soviet Union to tell them about Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a different culture, a different language, a different approach to things. There were rules in the books at the time that no more than five people could gather without a permit. There were heavy-duty restrictions. we had to consider all that. How are we going to approach these people? Now, we had taken a group of them around the United States on a 10-day trip. There's a whole afternoon story in that deal. And they told us, see, to be effective, I must be a listener. You need to tell me where you're at so I can help you move to the next place. If I try to get you move on where I think you're at, I'm going to move you into the wrong place. It won't be any good. We asked these Russians, should we come to your country? And they said, absolutely. And here's how you do it. They said, if you come as a government mission, you're going to get a show and tell. They'll give you a KGB agent that will take you around and nothing will be accomplished. They said, you know us now, and you know some other people, and here's another list of people. Write us all letters and say, we're going to be in Moscow on such and such a date. We'd like to stop by and visit. And we will confirm that. Shelley's been there. That's how you do business there. So, four of us and an interpreter were picked to spend 17 days just sharing the AA message with these folks who we really needed to be effective. There wasn't any pressure. It's just that if we didn't do the job, we're another 5 years before anything's going to happen. Don't put any pressure on me. Mm-hmm. Millions of lives are at stake, but don't worry about it. But we got by there because I learned a long time ago there's not millions of lives at stake. There's one. Mine. And then when you show up, there's two. And that's what we're all about. So in the midst of all of that, we got a chance to try being effective. How can we approach this in a way that will... First of all, I kept saying, we don't have any way to relate to God. We don't believe in God. But as we listened, we found they were very, very spiritual people. In fact, we had to laugh. They said, we don't have any history of God. Would you like to go see the big cathedral? Now, they were museums to them at that time, but they were just a very spiritual people. We went over our traditions with them, and the comment of one Russian was, you should have no trouble here. What you have here is communism in its purest form. See, they weren't communists. They were socialist republic on the way to communism. There should be no problem with that in principle. So we dealt with it one day at a time, trying to find out how can we best serve them so they can get it going. There were two events, and then my comments are over. I've got a whole day of talk. This was a trip beyond belief for a country boy like me. There was one tiny little group in Moscow called the Moscow Beginners Group that had been started by an Episcopal priest who was insane. Now, that's just the way it was. But somewhere he had power to move things. He got us inside the Kremlin and set things up. The guy was something else. And what he had done in setting it up was set it up according to AA's principles. Pure and simple. They operated by the traditions. There were step meetings. I remember the joy of sitting in a meeting with the Moscow Beginners Group, and a fellow named Sasha was talking, former radio announcer who had lost his job, because at that time, if you were caught as a drunk, it was a crime. You lost your apartment, you lost your job, you went to treatment. If you slipped, you went to Siberia. You were a social deviant. You got to know that we're not that far away from that in this country. Sasha's talking, and it was really interesting, because he speaks Russian and I speak English. So our interpreter, who is a simultaneous translator, Sasha would say something, and then the interpreter would let us know what he had said. And Sasha would start talking again, which gave me the opportunity, since I didn't understand the language, while he's talking, I can listen about what he just said and really think about that. Then pay attention to what he said this time. It sounds complicated, but it wasn't. He said, I had no history of God, but I wanted what these people had, meaning that small group of Russians who were not drinking anymore. He wanted what they had. So he said, I did what they did, and I found a spiritual power deep within myself. And I rose to that, because that's what happened to me too. He found a power here. But the main thing was he wanted what these people had. Then we were interrogated by the Ministry of Health. We weren't talked with, we were interrogated. We sat in a little room, and the Minister of Health was here, and the guy sitting over here in the corner like this, I don't know who he was, but I wouldn't mess with him. He was watching us, and he was watching the Minister of Health. This wasn't a friendly environment. And this guy is interrogating us for a little over an hour. And please know that because all of us were more interested in being effective than being right, we set aside our personal agendas somehow and never defended AA. You never have to defend AA. You never have to defend who you are. I just have to share my experience. You can't fault that. You don't have to like it, but you can't fault it. At the end of a little over an hour of this interrogation, the Minister of Health said, "What can we do to help you get this started here?" Now, what are you going to answer? Okay, this is outside of my realm. I said, give them space. That's all we need is space. Tom and I know that the job he and I did in North Carolina in corrections was mainly about getting space. Open the doors here. Give them a little room or something. Let somebody in that knows what's going on. That's the big job. The next day, it was Thanksgiving Day, they allowed this little group to hold a special meeting in the Ministry of Health. The other thing I meant by giving them space, and this is what I must do with people I work with to be effective, I've got to give them space to have their own experience, not my experience. You can't have mine. I need to help you create the space around you where you can have your own. And that takes a little bit of time. And it's very hard on me. I have a human ego and I have a spiritual ego. And my spiritual ego is even harder to deal with than the human ego, because it has the answer. And every now and then it gets to think it has the answer. It's not a very long trip from one to the other, is it, Tom? Oh, my group. Oh, geez, protect me from that. So effectiveness is about me showing up, being willing to give them space, showing them precisely what I did. If you want what I have, here's what I did. That doesn't mean you have to do that. You may discover along the way, as most people do, you really don't want what I have. I'm like Tom. I'm a busy rascal. Life is about living. And whether I'm busy with AA or Thursday night, I got really busy with one of my favorite activities. I took my grandchildren to see Blue's Clues stage show. I would much rather watch Shakespeare, but this was fun. I missed Steve. Steve wasn't there. There's a new Steve. As you can tell, I'm also busy watching Blue's Clues on TV a lot. I know exactly what Pooh's going to say. One of the ways I effectively communicate with my four-year-old granddaughter is I can say, "Oh my." And she, in her tiny little four-year-old voice, says, "Oh my." She loves it. That's effective. The interaction of people is effectiveness. Okay? I can't do that if I'm judging you, if I'm deciding what you should have, if I'm deciding where you should be and what you should be doing. My hardest task is to keep that arena where we can play together and you don't have to worry about it. Okay? You can grow at your own pace. There are now over 185 registered groups in Russia. They took off from there. The most effective thing we did was the scariest thing we did. A fellow had written a book about Alcoholics Anonymous, a man named Shikharev, Dr. Shikharev. Good book. Sold out 50,000 copies overnight. They were hungry. Did you ever get to meet him? Interesting guy. Following that kind of success with a book, the Russians hold public meetings. They did that. Where the author and the appropriate government officials and everybody who's going to have anything to say about it gets to hear from the public what the second edition changes should be. That's what was going on then. And we were invited to this public forum. There were about 400 people. Police officers, what we would call social workers, regular people off the street, anyone who's interested in this new activity that's beginning to emerge. Very positive book, by the way, about AA. On the panel was a Russian tank commander that I had known from when they were here, who was absolutely opposed to AA. He said, "It's just another imperialist ploy to get your way of thinking into our country." When we were in Leningrad, I understood what he was saying. We stayed in a hotel across from the great, huge, six-block-long memorial to the siege of Leningrad. Millions of people died. And what they're saying is, never again, ever, will any outside force come into our country and do this to us again. So I understood. That's the battle we're going to have to overcome to get AA there. And so we're fighting it. And he's on this panel. And he and I had fun, by the way. At the end of our trip, we got down to actually talking to each other. Turns out we could identify because we had similar jobs in the past. He used to smuggle guns into Leningrad on a tank. And I used to smuggle stuff, too. While the goods were different, the job was the same. And it gave us a contact. And before we're through in New York, we're showing each other family pictures, of course. He took a picture, or saw a picture of my wife, and he says, "You should go home." It's very dangerous to leave such a beautiful woman alone for so long a time. And he showed me a picture of his wife, and I was kind. Lovely lady, but, you know, in fur and everything, it looked like a bear. I know she had to be a lovely lady. Anyway. He said to me that his concern was that he didn't want his grandchildren killing mine. Or mine killing his. We disagreed entirely on method. He really believed with adequate therapy, in a year or two, alcoholics were cured and could go on back into life. I just know better. That didn't matter. We were joined in brotherly and harmonious action. He was willing to let us try something because what they were doing wasn't working. And while he didn't agree with it, so there was that tone. That's being effective. When I can reconcile with you instead of trying to change you, I'm effective. See, if I sponsor you, I expect you to drink. That's what alcoholics do. The only time I've ever surprised by your behavior is when you become a decent person. And quit drinking. We were at this public forum. And the crew knows, and you know, I'm glib. I've had to live on my mouth since I was little. So I think on my feet. And if I don't have an answer, I can say something cute that will keep you laughing long enough for me to figure out what I was supposed to say. So I'm the spokesman for the group. Now I've got a hostile audience of 400 people. And the trick question came at me. I've learned to listen for them. The lady said, "How do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work in the Soviet Union?" Now, there's a trick question. Any answer I give is the wrong one. So I did what I've been taught to do here. I opened up, waited for it, and heard myself say, "I would be presumptuous to even have a guess. I've only been here 13 days. And they applauded. We made contact. The truth was, I have no idea. But it has worked in 144 other cultures. And it has worked for me. Yeah. So to be effective has to do with taking all those kinds of risks. The only risk is not taking one. Yeah. You can't say anything wrong to a new person. They're not listening to you anyway. And if they catch you on it later, you can remind them how sick they were. Real effectiveness, as I understand it, isn't me staying sober. That's God's business and I participate in it. Nor is it me getting you sober, because I don't get you sober. Real effectiveness is when I watch you after we work together, go find you one. That's when I've been effective. That's the peace Bill gave us. But there were thousands who might cheerfully want what I've been so freely given, and they in turn might help others. That's when I know I've been effective. It's when I meet second, third generation, no matter how goofy they are, it means that the job I did at least carried forward. I'll straighten up the mess later. Real effectiveness means that my wife knows where I am. That's effective living. She's not afraid for me or for her. It means my grandchildren know where I am. My 4-year-old granddaughter, I know she doesn't know what a map is, but she thinks it's fascinating that I'm in Virginia. She doesn't even know what that means, but I'm there. About communication. I've got to listen and I've got to talk. Okay? Because the real work will happen after I am dead and gone. If I'm truly effective after I'm dead, somebody like me who shows up will get the same shot I got. I won't have changed anything so that it becomes unrecognizable. I love you as you are where you are. That's effective. Chuck hated everybody, including me. But I didn't care. I loved him. He was much more entertaining than most of you. And there's nothing like 6 weeks of solid hate to make you think, this guy's really going to be good. One quick story on Chuck, because it affects effectiveness.
Make it long enough for me to go back to the old
guy. I can stress this one out.
He's going to tell the story slow.
After we had finally, after a year, gotten through the step work and Chuck began to emerge as Chuck, he got rid of some stuff. Circumstances were such that his real father had died and left him $5,000 right at the time when he needed to make some financial amends. We got that cleared out of the way, got him a little truck, and he had some time on his hands. He'd had 180-some jobs. He was not unemployable. He just couldn't hold a job. Well, when you tell the boss, go screw yourself, they don't keep you. And he did that a lot. Anyway, he came to me one day and he said, there's one thing I didn't tell you. I've been afraid to tell you because every time I told anybody this, they made fun of me. He said, all I really wanted to be was an actor. It's going to be a good one. He kept me entertained for a year. I mean, this is a drama queen. And I got to thinking, I said, Chuck, listen, you don't have a job right now. Your men's are taken care of. You got a decent car. The other thing you've always wanted to do is go to Disneyland. He'd never done any kid stuff. It's one of the reasons he was so pissed. I said, look, you got a couple grand. Why don't you go out to Disneyland? Take 2 weeks and drive out there. And I know some actors. We'll hook you up with somebody, and they can tell you what the price you're going to have to pay is to become an actor. There's a price for everything. So I hooked him up with one of the guys we know on the Murphy Brown Show while he was out there. He was taking him around Warner's, just showing him the lot. And the producer of the show, they ran into him on the lot, and introductions went on, and my friend said, and Chuck wants to be an actor. Producer says, hell, we can use him right now. We need extras. So 2 weeks after he hits Los Angeles, he's on the Murphy Brown Show. Call him, he says, what's going on? What's this all about? He needed to expand into his own arena. And all my job is to provide him with the necessary tools, whether it be step work, a book, people, an environment, the tools so he can explore that environment. Now, he hated God. Got him into acting school. They think he's great. He really is good. His first stage play in Los Angeles, guess what part he got? He was an evangelistic preacher. And they tell me he kicked ass and took names. So how do you measure your effectiveness? Tom wanted some interaction. Let's talk about that. How do you know when you've been effective? What's your guide? Yeah.
Hey, it's Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. I have a question.
Somebody.
And maybe it's because I'm new to the program. Everyone else seems so articulate. I mean, everybody, I think, can get down in black and white what they think. Well, what you feel is so difficult for me to verbalize. Did you all have trouble with that?
Okay. Was there trouble verbalizing how you feel instead of being articulate about how you think? Yes, because at the beginning, all the feelings felt the same. Panic. I don't know whether I feel good or bad. I do know I feel panic. And how do you discuss, I feel panic?
Well,
Well, you come to me and you say, I feel panic. I'm terrified. And I can share with you, yeah, some mornings I feel the same way. Here's what I do about it. We discuss it. You can't describe your feelings, nor is it even important. What you do is describe, I'm feeling something. What a surprise. Okay? To be able to finally sort out, we reach a place where we can't tell the difference between the true and the false. Yeah, panic. I'm starting to feel something. Yeah. And I don't know what to do with it. What do I do with my feelings? Feel them? You don't have to do anything. Okay. Process them? Please don't process them. Just feel them. And if you got to cry, go cry. If you want to scream, go somewhere else. But scream. Does that help any? Tom, would you add to that?
The only thing that I know, I had the feeling when I came in that I was the dumbest guy in every room I sat in. Because I'd hear people who sounded so brilliant and healed that I felt light years away from where they were. And the guy who spoke at my fifth meeting of AA was the first person I had ever heard put words to how I felt. And I really, really valued that because it sort of helped me start framing a language that I could talk about the thing with. Because before that, all I felt was awful. Yeah. And guilty and deeply ashamed and all that. But I didn't know how to describe those things. So it was helpful to me that I started hearing people put some language to it that started to make sense. You know, I always sat in meetings. You're braver than me because I always sat in meetings burning with a desire to ask questions, but I felt like it sounded so stupid. And then I finally learned that what I wanted to ask, probably the person in the next chair wanted to ask the same thing. And so, but I very much identify with that whole business of total ignorance about the condition. Some people have been through so much treatment that they sound like a medical dictionary when they come in and got a lot of language. But it may not have much to do with the condition. You know, it's just a whole bunch of language that clutters up life. You know, and getting to a point where I can realistically understand what it is I'm dealing with. It's where inventory starts really putting stuff together, making it have some real purpose, some real value in my life. But I think it is important to me.
I went to my first sponsor early on and said, Bruce, I feel so guilty. He said, you should. Look at what you've done.
Yeah.
Now, here's what we can do to straighten that up. But you should.
Yeah.
I'm so ashamed. You should be.
Do you just let the chucks of the world spew their hate for 6 weeks, 10 years? Not 10 years, but you know.
Say it again.
Do you just let the chucks of the world spew their hate for 6 or 8 weeks or whatever it takes?
Oh, okay.
I do, yes. While they're with me in a separate space, I immediately begin to tell them, you don't want to do this with all these nice people. Okay? If that's how you feel, be quiet. We'll talk about it later. Don't disrupt these nice people. Okay? If they don't get to do that, pretty soon they get tired of it too. But yes, I do. Because I know about that kind of hate. And if everybody keeps this out, it just intensifies it. Pretty soon we can start laughing at it. We say things like, did you hear what you just said? Yeah.
Al,
how do you help a new person kind of on the other end getting past over-intellectualizing or analyzing everything?
How do you help a new person get over intellectualizing and analyzing everything? Lobotomy is not a bad thing. Which means, Al, I've never figured that one out. Duct tape helps.
I tell you,
focus.
It's an awfully good defense.
Yeah.
You know, the people can talk you to death. And it's a very good defense to keep from listening to anything. Like, I have a fairly standard rule of thumb. Now, there are not any standards for the thing, but a fairly standard rule of thumb. When I'm sponsoring somebody, I don't like to let anybody get up in front of a group and talk till they got about 9 months, you know, making a talk. If they are people who can communicate readily, it's a year. and the reasoning is obvious. It's just that. You know, people who are handy with communication are often not handy with listening. And it's a great way to keep from getting involved with just a verbal barrage. Same with comedy. You know, that comedy very often has very little to do with humor. I know that's the way, in a general kind of way, I deal with folk like that. It is tough with people who are highly knowledgeable about conditions but don't have them connected to their life. And tell you, my least favorite person to work with is the guy who is religiously intact, but his life is screwed up like Hogan's goat. And trying to get through that cloud of righteousness to a real life connection with the Spirit is a big, big battle. And any day I'll take somebody that is absolutely on fire with hate for the whole business over somebody who sees themselves religiously intact. And it's just... I know that sounds like kind of scary ground to get into, but folk who have caught into this kind of delusional notion that they're okay there, but their life's falling apart, the real deal is, how do you get a real power connected to a real life killer illness? And so it's a challenge, a huge, huge challenge.
Technique-wise, though, because of the way I do it, meaning you come to my house, we sit down, I read the book out loud, and we go from there. It helps with the focus, because I'll let you intellectualize for a couple meetings, and I have to remind you, you came here to learn something, and so did I. How are you going to learn anything if you talk 50 minutes out of the hour? And so we have a way to get back into it. And even if the information doesn't click, the new way of doing things does, and eventually the information clicks. But it becomes a tool. I'm like Tom. It was a year before I was allowed to talk. Except in the 12-step study school. Couldn't chair a meeting, couldn't get up there at the podium. Does that help? No real answer, but there's some things.
Yeah. It's really a tough issue. It really is. Sometimes we really get injurious in talking, you know, like saying things like, nobody's too dumb to get sober, but some are too smart. That's kind of an injurious kind of way to treat folk who happen to be handicapped with a lot of education. You know, because it's kind of insulting their way. You know, folks can't help that. That's what they got. You know, and so in dealing with it, very important to not write them off as being, you know, so kind of a wandering idiot just because they happen to be smart. And I think that thing of letting the book handle it, you know, letting the process handle it, is really the bottom line deal. On deal with the concept that's laid out here and not what you brought to the table. You know, and it'll do it. You know, the program will take us through it. I don't care what the barriers are if we'll open up and let it happen. You know, but that is, you hit a real sensitive area of deep, deep trouble, as you usually do.
my sponsor hit me with that. Now, at the very beginning, he says, we've been talking, because there were three of them, we don't even think the truth's going to work for you. Because you take the truth in and your ego catches it. And by the time you use it, it's all warped. So he said, what we suggest for you is that we suggest you forget everything you think you know about anything, particularly spiritual matters. If any of it worked, you wouldn't be here. And I fought a little bit. I said, come on, I must have learned some truth somewhere along the way. He says, it's doubtful, but it is possible. He says, I'll grant that it's possible. But anything that really is truth will be truth when we're all through, too. And the rest of it's all garbage. Just lay it down. And that really helped. Focused right back on up. If I'm wanting to argue with you about it, it's my opinion. The truth never has to be defended. It just is. I still like to argue. There's nothing like a good game of Zorro with an intellectual idiot.
I heard what you said too, and I really like this meeting people at the level of their understanding.
Yeah.
I'm thinking I can put up with the one that's in turmoil all the time, angry, fearful, whatever. I understand it's out, you know. I have a difficult time putting up with know-alls.
Yeah.
They know everything about everything, whether it's a big book or whatever. I just turned 15 years sober. I feel like I'm brand new, asking 100 questions.
Two years ago, an old timer in Denver, 33 years sober at that time, came to me to go through the steps because he'd never done it. And nobody else would talk to him. 33 years and not doing anything about untreated alcoholism makes you a pain in the ass. We went through weeks where most of the sessions we were in was me helping to unlearn him so we could get down to this. Got to the third step, had a wonderful third step experience together just prior to Christmas 2 years ago. Sent him home to make a list, and I haven't seen him since. Called me once and said, I got busy and haven't got the list done. And I said, one name counts as a list, you know, and I haven't seen him since. Sometimes you just give it your shot. I'm still here.
Let me tell you a quick one I just had. I'll tell you about the good ones. I won't tell you about all the bad ones. I was in California a week or so ago, and there was a fellow that came up to me that he introduced himself like he was showing his merit badges by how many chips he'd picked up, you know, with... That he was, he said, I'm a professional newcomer. And so I just decided to just sort of take him on just a little bit. And he was trying to get me to respond to that and add to his merit badges or something. And I said, well, let me just suggest one thing to you. Why don't you quit being a professional newcomer and become a real newcomer? And it took a while. But this guy had a cliche for everything. You know, he'd been around the program so much that his mind was just filled with meaningless platitudes and cliches for every situation. And so what I did with him was head off every one. You know, every time he'd come, I said, no, don't put that on. Yeah. And it took a long time to get through that riddle of stuff that was in his mind and get down to a real contact with who he was and what he was about. Because his mind was filled with all that stuff. And I know he didn't like the conversation, but he engaged in the conversation. If he had not, have quit. But he engaged in the conversation. And he came to a point where I knew that he had heard it and connected with it. The next morning, the guy came to, not that day, but the next morning, a guy came to me and said, man, you'll never know how much I appreciate that. Yeah. Because that's what it took, was to get past that litany of stuff to where he was a real human being connecting with a real program of recovery. And see, he was so caught up in that kind of mess of stuff that he couldn't even hear what was going on around him. Now, he may be like that guy. Who knows what'll happen? But he left that day, and he went out and did some stuff, and he came back the next morning really pleased with what he was doing. And I think that's part of our effectiveness is how do you cut through that stuff and get down to real issues? And it does. It takes some hard-nosed confrontation sometimes, but whatever it takes, you know, it's a real deal. Let me mention just a couple real anecdotes he reminded me of that maybe set the stage for what we'll come back to that. And plus, I just wanted to share this thing about effectiveness really does have to do with where you are. and how you engage it. I never did go to Russia, but I had some Russians over here one time, and I was visiting someplace, and they had a contingent of Russian folks that were going around the country trying to learn stuff, I guess. And they said, would you go over and meet them? And I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to meet them. And so I went over there, and they introduced me to the Russians and gave me a lot of names I couldn't pronounce. And then they said, would you just speak to them a little bit? And I said, well, sure. So I proceeded to lay a real heavy sermon on them for about 5 minutes. And so, you know, in a conversation, you kind of pause and look for a response. And so I got to the appropriate point, and I paused, and there was two women in the front row. One of them pointed at the other one and said, psychologist. Well, okay. They didn't speak English. They had stood and nodded and grinning the whole time. I just assumed that everybody in the world spoke English. But they didn't know that, you know. So that was probably not effective. They knew I was a very charming, friendly fella. But not a clue about that. And the other thing I say about this business about accepting people where they are, you know, and having meaningful kind of relationship, like your Russian buddy you were talking about with the exchange about family. I was a guy, he's a researcher, fella, not an alcoholic, but he's a world-class, eminent researcher. And some people kind of engineered us to get together because they knew we were polar opposites on some beliefs about stuff. And we had a wonderful time in a good debate. A really good debate. And this guy really and truly, his name's Wexler, and he's an eminent researcher. And he'd done some studies about alcoholism, and he was just profoundly unimpressed with AA. And so he said, I will never understand. I go into those meetings, and I listen to them, and none of it makes sense. It's disorder and chaos and junk. So we were participating in a program, and he was lecturing about substance abuse. Jesus, I mean, just the thought of that term just makes me want to gag. And so I listened to him patiently, and about midweek, we were going to be there a week. About midweek, I said, man, I had enough of this stuff. And they had planned a big dinner. And I found a few other drunks, and I said, let's go to a meeting. Man, I got to get out of here. And so we went. Next morning, I ran into the fella, and he said, where were you last night? I was counting on continuing our discussion over dinner. And I said, well, let me tell you where I was. I said, I got a few other drunks, and we loaded up in the car. We rode over to this next city. We went to the worst part of town. Drove up to an old frame house that had probably been condemned in urban renewal, had a sofa sitting on the front porch, springs hanging out of it. Walked in, got a cup of coffee, and the stuff was so old it was green. And walked into a room, and a bunch of people in there fat-mouthing and talking and cussing. And we sat down around a table, and the room was blue with smoke. And I sat in the middle of that, and I said, man, I am in the solution. He said, I'll never understand you people. I said, that's fine. But we respected each other. It was a healthy respect. I respect what he was doing. He didn't have to agree with me. But we were both people who were committed to our endeavors, and we had respect for each other. And I think some of that is about this whole business of how am I going to be infected. And if I've got to write everybody off who doesn't agree with me, I'm not going to be very effective.
Very briefly, because I've got one incident, Al, that's a direct answer to your question. Briefly, don't discount the intuitive. Start to rely on it. You've cleared away the stuff, you can do that. A year and a half ago, I quit my job, got me a new guy the next morning, 3 weeks sober, treatment center counselor. Knew way too much, just kept drinking. And he was telling me all the stuff he knew in those first early sessions. And I said to him, you're right. You probably know more about alcoholism than I even want to know. But everything you know still allowed you to drink 3 weeks ago. And he got it. That was fat. I didn't want to say your stuff is crap because it isn't. But everything he knew still let him drink. And that worked. And that was intuitive. I'm not smart enough to think of that. And I don't use that as a rule now to tell everybody. But that one did work.
Yeah. When we come back, I think what we're going to do is nudge a little bit. I know Donald would like to go there. Is a nudge a little bit into the sponsorship function itself, you know, and talk about that a little bit in relation to effectiveness, and this business about how the example needs to incorporate how we live, and that's the next section in this thing that we'll get into. So, have a good lunch.
Suit y'all.
What time do we come back?
One time.